This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. Meghna Chakrabarty is out today. In February of 1941, Henry Luce announced the arrival of what he called an American century. Luce was the influential publisher of Life magazine, and his phrase caught on, and many people would eventually embrace his idea that America's great moment had arrived. So what became of that American century? Boston University historian Andrew Basevich argues it's over, that it promised much more than it delivered, and that Americans would do well to digest some of the century's difficult lessons. Basevich invited a number of distinguished historians to reflect upon those lessons. Their essays are collected in a new book, edited by Basevich, called The Short American Century, A Postmortem. Andrew Basevich says in that famous 1941 Life magazine editorial, Henry Luce was pushing for America to get involved in World War II.
He uses Life as a vehicle to express those views in the broadest terms, in a narrow sense calling for the United States to intervene on the side of Great Britain, but more broadly announcing that the American moment had arrived, that our time, our period of global dominion, our calling was now to be fulfilled by seizing the reins of global leadership and to create what he called an American century.
An American century, and he couched it in almost messianic terms. He said it must be a sharing with all people of our Bill of Rights, our Declaration of Independence, and our Constitution. And he calls for an internationalism of the people, by the people, for the people. How did people of that time respond to that call?
The significance of the essay, I think, lies in part in its title, this notion of an American century. And I think your point about religiosity is tremendously important. At one point, he calls upon America to be the Good Samaritan to the world. And back in the late 1940s and 1950s, this notion of a religiously connected mission had great resonance for large numbers of Americans. So the idea of an American century, God calling upon us to lead and transform the world, really was a very powerful sort of notion.
Now, by the time World War II ends in 1945, the U.S. was in many ways a lone giant of military and economic power. So at that point, at least, didn't it seem to many as though Luce's prophecy had come true?
Well, I think it did. On the other hand, why did World War II end the way it did? And the answer is not that the United States, with its loyal British ally, took on Nazi Germany and defeated it. A much more accurate answer would be that Joseph Stalin's Soviet Union took on Nazi Germany with a useful assist by the United States and Great Britain. And my point there is that from an American perspective, it may have appeared that an American model stood triumphant. But if you looked at the events that had just occurred from the perspective of the Kremlin, the image was somewhat different. What had occurred was that the Red Army had risen from the ashes and had destroyed the Nazi war machine. And to the extent that you're willing to credit that as at least a partially accurate rendering of the history, then the American century, even in its earliest stages, does not really provide an accurate description of what the global order was at that time.
And in your opening essay, you make the case for the adjective short, as in the short American century, because not long after the victory of World War II, the American century encounters some big bumps in the road, specifically the Korean War, Vietnam. How did these two foreign adventures challenge Luce's view of the American century?
When the United States emerged from World War II, Americans took from that episode, as horrific as it was, a conviction that, at least in some circumstances, war works. Korea and Vietnam challenged that expectation. When, at least for a time, both before and after 9/11, many Americans believed that military power really had become our strong suit. Reflecting on Korea and Vietnam should have been a warning against that. When you go to war, the risks are enormous, the uncertainties are great, and the costs are likely to be far greater than you anticipate.
Now, from Korea to Vietnam, you draw a pretty straight line, right to 9/11. I'm talking about your essay in particular. To 9/11, to Afghanistan, Iraq, the economic meltdown of 2008. Is there one point in particular that you would say marked the end of the American century in there?
Well, I think that the Vietnam War may not have marked the end of the American century, but it's at that point that the end comes into view. And it's not simply because of our failure in Vietnam, but because that's the period of time, as the 60s turned to the 1970s, that the unbelievable prosperity that we enjoyed in the immediate post-World War II period begins to become undone.
Mm-hmm.
For example, the trade balance goes into the red, where it's been ever since, I think, 1972. When I was a kid, we made the stuff that the world wanted and the world bought from us. It's beginning in the 1960s. That begins to crumble, pointing toward where we have arrived today as a debtor nation that is highly dependent, for example, on energy that comes from abroad.
And you make a case that it's important to acknowledge an end to this idea of the American century and the idea of American exceptionalism. Why is it so important that we acknowledge this?
I think it's because we need to be realistic about it. I'm about to turn 65. And now I could pretend that I'm still as vigorous as I was when I was 35 or 45, but I'd be deluding myself and in many respects probably would be exposing myself to harm, to danger. And the United States needs to accept the fact that we no longer live in the world of 1945 or 1955, that whatever dominion we once enjoyed, we don't anymore. The world of the 21st century is going to be a multipolar world. We are going to have to learn to live with, to some degree, accommodate the desires, needs, purposes of other great powers.
And yet it seems as though we're incapable of digesting and embracing what you're saying. And it seems like the idea is anathema in the context of our political debate. I want to play two pieces of tape about this. The first is Mitt Romney making a foreign policy speech at the Citadel in Charleston, South Carolina, October 2011. Let's just listen.
This century must be an American century. In an American century, America has the strongest economy and the strongest military in the world. In an American century, America leads the free world, and the free world leads the entire world.
And here's President Barack Obama from this year's State of the Union address.
America is back. Anyone who tells you otherwise, anyone who tells you that America is in decline or that our influence has waned doesn't know what they're talking about.
So there's President Obama. So what do you make of that? Both Romney and Obama making a case for American dominance, power, exceptionalism.
Well, candidates and presidents probably have a pretty accurate sense of what plays out there in Peoria. I interpret those kinds of remarks in that context. We as a people don't want to acknowledge the predicament that we faced. We are reluctant to concede that if there was an American century, it's over or coming to an end. We want to hear those kinds of notions expressed, and those kinds of notions win votes. My problem is, I think that empirically, they don't stand up. They're not sustainable, and they invite us to live in a world that is not the real world, and that's a problem.
Was there ever a moment in your view, though, that when this country made good on Luce's idea of the American century? I was going to ask you about victory in World War II. You've talked about that. What about the end of the Cold War? Aren't there moments that suggest that Luce's vision had merit and maybe even substance?
I don't think so. In the post-war period, there's no question that the United States was the most powerful and influential nation on Earth. It's just that the concept of American century is imbued with something much more than primacy. Mm. It implies that we are a nation that defines history, understands history, delivers history to some intended goal or outcome. And just speaking for myself, I think that that's ludicrous. To revert to the sort of rhetoric of Henry Luce is a dodge, and it's not worthy of a great nation.
In your introduction, in your essay, you call this book a sort of dissenter's guide to the American century. And you do present, there are essayists in there who have different views from yours. And I want to talk about David Kennedy of Stanford University. He argues, and I'll just quote a tiny bit, much of the American century, despite the chronic tensions and occasional blunders of the Cold War, and especially the tragedy of Vietnam, was on the whole a laudably successful affair. And he argues that the overall cause was a good one.
You accurately summarize Professor Kennedy's essay that the United States used its power for the most part responsibly in creating institutions and norms, the United Nations, the World Bank, NATO, that contributed in a very useful way toward creating an international order that at a minimum at least avoided another world war. But he concludes by saying that in the post-Cold War period, and especially the post-9/11 period, American hubris led us to cast aside that legacy. So for him, too, for Professor Kennedy as well, the American century has ended, a good American century that's now been recklessly flung away.
Let me ask you about something that struck me about all this. In spite of all of America's blunders, and I have a particular perspective on this, I grew up in Europe in the 60s and the 70s, and even then, through the terrible years of Vietnam, of Watergate, it wasn't hard to find Europeans who believed in the essential promise of American ideals and democracy, even if they were critical of actual policies.
I agree with that insight in that the American century, the idea of an American century, it's not just Americans who find that very seductive.
Yes.
It is other people around the world who look to America to be better.
But based on the evidence, are they right to do so?
I honestly don't think so. And I think that the mistake in expecting America to be more virtuous, they're setting themselves up for a fall. I think it's a mistake to expect the United States to come bail you out. Even to the extent that we once imagined that we could do so, certainly at the present moment, in this century, we don't have the resources to do that.
Andrew Bacevich, in your concluding essay, you write, Americans today would do well to temper any claims or expectations of completing the world's redemption. You seem to be calling for a shift away from the American century toward a new American humility, a new American prudence, a new American modesty. Is that about right?
I'm for all of those. I'm for humility. I'm for modesty. I'm for recognizing the limits of our wisdom, for recognizing the limits of our resources, certainly recognizing the limits of our military power. But modesty, prudence, we need to carve those at the entrance to the State Department and the Pentagon and let those be the words that guide us.
Well, the book is The Short American Century, a Postmortem. It's edited by Andrew Bacevich. Andrew Bacevich, thanks so much for bringing it to us, and thanks for coming in to talk about it. We're very grateful.
Thank you.
Andrew Bacevich and some of his fellow scholars will be reading from and discussing The Short American Century tonight at 7 at the Brookline Booksmith. And here's a quick update from Detroit. In the top of the ninth, two outs, the Tigers lead the Red Sox 2-1. Radio Boston is a production of WBUR with regular contributions from The Angle at Boston.com. I'm Anthony Brooks. Meghna will be back tomorrow. Join us again for more Radio Boston.